The Age of Washington. When George Washington was inaugurated on Wall Street in New York City as the first president of the United States under the current federal constitution in 1789, he couldn't know, and no one could know, that the backdrop to federal politics over the next quarter century and more would be the wars of the French Revolution. George Washington came to office with unique advantages. He had qualities that no president since him has matched, and qualities indeed that no one can possibly match. First of all, he was the conquering general of America's victorious attempt to establish its independence from Great Britain in the Revolution. Secondly, he was an American Cincinnatus, his example during the Revolution recalling the career of the ancient Roman figure who mythically had taken the dictatorial power during war and then the war over, had resigned it without claiming anything for himself. Washington had behaved in a similar fashion. He had been, Washington, the president of the Philadelphia Convention that wrote the U.S. Constitution, and in fact, the person with whom in mind the Philadelphia Convention had crafted Article II, the executive article of the Constitution. And he had been, in 1789, a unanimous victor in the Electoral College. No other president has ever won a unanimous victory in the Electoral College, and Washington was going to duplicate this feat in 1792. As the first president under the new Constitution, Washington had to establish precedents that would stand ever after for the behavior of people in that office. He did not know how to behave as president on a very basic level. He had to question how he should interact with the public. On one hand, he couldn't be so readily available to people as John Jay, for example, had been when President of the Confederation. It could not be the case with George Washington as President of the United States that one could knock on the President's door and have him answer the door. This was an impossibility on two scores. One, that Washington was essentially a rock star in his day, and he was the most famous American and the most popular, as was demonstrated by the victorious procession that his progress from Mount Vernon to New York to take the oath of office proved to be. And secondly, people had the idea that this new government had to be respectable in the eyes of Europeans, and well, how respectable would it seem to people who were used to having their kings process in lines behind gigantic bodyguards of horsemen and in very expensive carriages and so on, if the president were just another Joe who answered his own door or whose footman answered the door. So Washington could not be so readily available. On the other hand, he didn't want to be as distant from common folk as European monarchs were prone to be. He couldn't be George III expecting anyone who approached him to bow and avert his gaze until the royal personage spoke. So what to do? Well, according to Senator from Pennsylvania who kept a diary of goings on in the Capitol in his 2-year term as senator, Washington had these annual events called levee at which he would meet with people who had been specially invited. And according to Maclay, what happened was that he arrived early the evening he was to attend the levee, and when everybody else who was invited had arrived, they were led into the presidential presence by a footman who arrayed them in a semicircle in front of President and Mrs. Washington. They then were spoken to each briefly in turn, and this progressed from one end of the semicircle to the other and then back, and then Mrs. Washington addressed each of them in turn, and there was a brief exchange involved with each of these little interactions, and at that point the footman led everybody out of the room. Maclay said this struck him as entirely monarchical and he would never go again. In fact, after doing this a few times, Washington decided he'd had enough of it too. But you can see that the point is that people didn't really know how the president ought to act. They had an idea that he should be august, but he shouldn't be Augustus. And so finding a happy medium was going to be a matter of trial and error. Another example of the fact, or another illustration of the claim that Washington didn't know how to behave as president, came the first time he sought the advice and consent of the Senate in connection with a treaty. Of course, Article 2 says that the President may enter into treaties with the advice and consent of the Senate. And so one day when the Senate was in session, there came a knock at the door and the sergeant-at-arms hollered, "Mr. President, the President of the United States and the Secretary of War," at which point Washington and Henry Knox proceeded into the room. And what happened there was a little interchange in which Washington asked through Knox for the senator's advice on a treaty that had been negotiated with some Indians in the Northwest, and the Senate sat silently, and then finally somebody asked that the treaty be read. After it had been read, somebody said, "Well, I couldn't hear it, it had to be read again," and Washington became increasingly frustrated as senators discussed the question whether they shouldn't appoint a committee to take the treaty into consideration and have the committee issue a report, which might then be discussed by the Senate. Finally, Washington and Knox picked up the treaty, carried it out of the room, and one witness said that as Washington left the room, he said, quote, "I'll be damned if I ever come here again." And so, ever since George Washington, the prerogative of the Senate to give its, quote, advice in relation to treaties has been a dead letter. Washington tried to get their advice once, and it didn't work, and he never went back, and neither has any of his successors. So just as the Philadelphia Convention expected, Washington's experience and Washington's behavior were going to form precedents that would be binding on all of Washington's successors. Washington also, for a brief while, tried taking majority vote in the cabinet as making policy for the administration. So regardless of his own position personally, he would take a vote among the five people, including himself, Secretary of State Jefferson, Secretary of War Knox, Secretary of Treasury Hamilton, and Attorney General Randolph. And whoever won, won, and that would be the president's position. Well, obviously this came from the example of the British, but obviously it also was contrary to the American Constitution's presumption or statement that the executive power would be lodged in a president of the United States. And so after a brief while, Washington dispensed with these cabinet majority votes and went back to using the cabinet as an advisory body. First, Congress had difficulty with deciding exactly how the Constitution ought to work as well. So it had several important things it had to do. And in fact, the first Congress took at least three steps that have been affecting people who live in the United States ever since. First of all, when George Washington's hand came off the Bible, and yes, it was on a Bible when he took the oath of office, that was a precedent that has been followed by virtually every one of his successors. And he also, at the end of his oath of office, said, "So help me God," which is not in the Constitution, is not required as part of the constitutional oath, but has been said by virtually all of his successors as well. Anyway, Congress found when Washington was through taking the oath of office that there was exactly one person in the executive branch, and that was Washington. So it hurriedly got about the business of creating executive departments, establishing in this order the State Department, the Treasury Department, and the War Department. And of course, these remain the three primary departments of the federal government even now, although in an Orwellian fit, the federal government renamed the War Department the Defense Department in the middle of the 20th century. A second very significant act taken by the first Congress was the creation of the judiciary branch. There was no, there were no personnel when the Congress and the Vice President, then the President, were inaugurated, and so Congress got about the business of creating a judicial branch. Despite James Madison's concession in Virginia that they would try having a judicial branch without any inferior courts, the Judiciary Act of 1789 created a three-tiered federal judicial system that we've had ever since. So even as the country grew about 100 times as populous, 103 times as populous, I guess, this is what it is today in 2013, and even as it became far more extensive in terms of territory, now stretching all the way from the East Coast to Hawaii and Alaska, yet you could still have the same three-tier system with a Supreme Court, as the Constitution requires, at the top, with federal district courts, federal trial courts, at least one in each state, says the Judiciary Act of 1789, and an intermediate level of federal judicial circuit courts of appeal. The Constitution merely says that there will be a Supreme Court with a Chief Justice and such inferior courts as Congress from time to time may ordain and establish. That is, it's entirely in the discretion of Congress whether there will be any federal judiciary other than a Supreme Court. And by my reading, if you ha say there has to be a Chief Justice, that means there have to be at least two judges. So anything beyond two judges is more than the Constitution requires, but is within Congress's discretion. And that's essentially the system that Congress created in 1789 we still have today. The number for nine, for the number of justices on the Supreme Court, was more or less set in the middle of the 19th century, and we've had it ever since. But it could have been greater, it could have been smaller, it could have been, I think, as few as two. Another feature of the Judiciary Act of 1789 is what's called Section 25, which is the part of the Judiciary Act that says that final decisions of state Supreme Courts will be appealable to the U.S. Supreme Court. So, and of course, these are only decisions involving federal law. So if you have a lawsuit in a state court and you appeal it to the state Supreme Court, and then you think the state Supreme Court is wrong about federal law, you can appeal the federal law question to the U.S. Supreme Court under the Judiciary Act of 1789, Section 25. As these matters were being decided, debated in Congress, James Madison in the House of Representatives kept insisting that the Congress had to take up the question of amendments. During the ratification process in several states, beginning with Massachusetts, Federalists had made a kind of deal with the people. If you'll ratify this admittedly imperfect Constitution, we promise that in the first Congress we will seek amendments. Well, Congressman Madison in the House of Representatives insisted on this. Other congressmen were put off, Fisher Ames of Massachusetts, for example, writing privately that it seems that Madison's concerns with domestic political problems in Virginia are making him bring this up, even though we have more important things to do, like creating the judiciary and creating the executive branch. Finally, however, Madison's promise that what he had in mind was not radically to change the distribution of powers between the states and the federal government, but merely to mollify some people who would otherwise have been well disposed toward the federal government by adding a few plain statements about individual and state rights. Finally, the Congress took this question up. The only exception to that description of what Madison intended to do was his proposal that the state governments be banned from infringing on freedoms, on people's religious freedom, their freedom of the press, or their right to trial by jury. This also, perhaps interestingly, is the only major part of Madison's program for amendments that was rejected by the Congress. Even the House of Representatives never approved of this, and so it did not form part of the collection of 12 proposals that the Congress ultimately referred to the states for their ratification in 1789. Of course, we know that the first 10 amendments are called the Bill of Rights nowadays, and those were 10 of the 12 that Congress referred to the states at Madison's urging, and largely as a result of Madison's drafting. Another of those 12 Madisonian products, if you want to look at them that way, was ratified as the 27th Amendment in 1992. So, yes, James Madison in 1789 led Congress to draft the 27th Amendment, which was ratified in 1992. And therein lies an interesting tale that we don't have time for. So, anyway, this suite of accomplishments by the Congress, creating the executive, creating the judiciary, referring the Bill of Rights, as I said, has shaped America's federal system ever since. In the Age of Washington, there were severe domestic policy divisions. One point at which these divisions became clear was on the question of federal assumption of state debts. So, when Congress created the Treasury Department, and of course it contemplated that there would be a Treasury Secretary, and soon enough, Alexander Hamilton, who was not President Washington's first choice, but who was recommended to him for the position by James Madison, perhaps Washington's chief advisor at this point, Hamilton took up the charge from Congress of referring to Congress proposals for the financial system that the new Congress ought to establish. And one element of Hamilton's program was assumption of state debts. What this meant was that Congress would pass legislation saying that the several states' debts incurred in financing the revolution would no longer be the responsibility of the separate state governments, but instead would become the responsibility of the federal government. Well, another way of understanding this is that Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, would no longer have to worry about the federal government's debts plus those of the 11 states that had joined the Union by ratifying the Constitution, and two that hadn't yet, or one that hadn't yet, or eventually none that hadn't yet, and 13 that had. But he would have control of and responsibility for these separate war debts, all in his hand, all in the bailiwick of the federal government. What was the use of this? Well, it would make it easier for the Treasury to manage the debt, and for Hamilton to ensure the federal government's good credit, if it didn't have to worry about its credit being undercut by the behavior of state governments, which had proven during the Revolution perfectly willing to put off paying, to issue paper money instead of paying in gold and silver, to issue legal tender laws, and so on. So this seemed likely to Hamilton to reduce the interest that Americans had to pay on their debt. On the other hand, it was seemingly going to fail of passage in the Congress. Jefferson, in his Annus, which is a collection of notes he kept and papers that he collected from his tenure as Secretary of State, described an exchange he had, a little event he was involved in, whose other participants were Secretary Hamilton and Congressman Madison. What Secretary Jefferson wrote was that one day after he'd been meeting with the president, he went out into the front of the president's house, and there he encountered Hamilton, who uncharacteristically was disheveled and was kind of muttering to himself. And when Jefferson asked him what the problem was, he said that he doubted that the assumption bill was going to pass in the House. As Hamilton explained it to Jefferson, if the assumption bill didn't pass in the House, the financial system that he had recommended to Congress would be ruined, and he would have to resign his position as Secretary of Treasury. This was a crisis, he said. Well, Jefferson told him he hadn't been keeping track of exactly what these proposals were about, but what he could do was he could hold a dinner involving Hamilton and Madison at his house. So according to Jefferson, he invited Congressman Madison and Secretary Hamilton to come to his house to discuss this question of assumption of state debts. And there, over dinner, the issue was resolved. And what ultimately happened was that Hamilton explained his concerns to Madison, and Madison told him, well, you know, I have something I'm worried about too, and that is the location of the federal capital. The federal capital, of course, was originally in New York, and Madison said, we Southerners think it's far too far north. It ought to be more centrally located, and we have an idea in mind that it should be on the Potomac, which is the boundary between Maryland and Virginia. Hamilton told him that he thought that if Madison would favor temporarily relocating the capital from New York to Philadelphia, where it had been, of course, before and during some of the Revolution, then Hamilton, could get the two senators from Pennsylvania to stop voting against an ultimate location on the Potomac. And in exchange, Hamilton wanted Madison to help Hamilton get assumption passed through the House. What Madison told Hamilton was that he and a couple of other Virginia congressmen could stop voting no on assumption, and Madison made clear he wasn't going to vote for it. He opposed it, but he was willing to stop voting. He'd just go stand in the ante room while Congress was voting on this question, let it pass. And so ultimately, the two of them agreed, shook hands, metaphorically at least, and we ended up with assumption of state debts and the federal capital in a swamp near a little village called Georgetown on the Potomac. And of course, for many decades thereafter, it was going to be a bedraggled little no-account capital, totally unlike what Europeans expected, and certainly unlike what people who were posted to ambassadorial posts there from places like Britain and France hoped to encounter. Jefferson later said that this was the worst deal he had ever made, because what it did was to allow Hamilton to implement his financial system. And we'll get back to why Jefferson disliked that in a couple of minutes. But the thing to note here is that in the short term, Hamilton's forecast proved accurate, and the interest rate that was being paid on American bonds almost immediately dropped by from 6% to 4%. So virtually immediately, the wizardry of Secretary Hamilton reduced the burden of taxation on Americans as a result of this assumption of state debts. Of course, the other thing to notice about it is that it elicited a very angry response from the General Assembly in Virginia, where Patrick Henry and And Light Horse Harry Lee, one the leading anti-federalist of the Virginia Ratification Convention in 1788, and the other a very vociferous federalist, co-authored a resolution of the Virginia General Assembly saying they disapproved of assumption. What they said was that you told us that the Congress was only going to have the powers that were expressly granted. That was, of course, Governor Randolph's position in the Virginia Ratification Convention in 1788. But here we have this assumption bill that there's nothing in the Constitution that says Congress can assume responsibility for state debts, and Virginians had their reasons for disliking this program, besides which they disliked the idea of Congress immediately setting off on this course of doing things that the Constitution didn't say it could do. And so they warned the Virginia General Assembly behind Patrick Henry, warned, "We're going to keep our eye on you. We're not going to accept this kind of government." Of course, the last time that Patrick Henry had given a constitutional warning to distant authority, the result had been the Revolution. So this was a serious matter. The second major measure over which there was substantial division in the early republic was the National Bank. This was another element of Hamilton's response to Congress's request that he submit a financial program to it. The bank bill contemplated that the Congress would be a 20 would own 20% of the shares. The federal government, I should say, would own 20% of the shares in this bank, which would be mainly a private institution. It would be authorized to issue bank notes, and the idea was that it would be able to loan money to the federal government. There should be a profit from it if it took in tax receipts, as was what the charter contemplated, and so there would be a substantial profit to the federal government. And this looked to Hamilton like a good way to emulate the British, who had, through the mechanism of the Bank of England, established a financial system that made Britain, despite its inferiority in natural resources to France and to Russia, become the great power in the world. Well, James Madison objected to this in the House, and he said it was unconstitutional, along the lines of Henry's resolution in 1790 in Virginia. He said there's nothing in the Constitution that says Congress can do this, and Congress is only supposed to be able to do the things the Constitution says it can do. He said, in fact, this idea of having Congress have a power to charter corporations came up in Philadelphia, and we rejected it. Jefferson echoed this argument in the cabinet, and the two of them also said about a couple of clauses under which Federalists were claiming you could purport to have found congressional power to charter bank corporations. The General Welfare Clause is not a grant of power. It's just an introduction to the list of powers that follows immediately in Article 1, Section 8. In other words, Article 1, Section 8 begins by saying Congress can levy taxes, quote, to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare. And then it says Congress shall have power to, in Article 1, Section 8, and lists, depending how you count, either 17 or 18 powers. The point that Madison in the House and Jefferson in the cabinet insisted on was that was just an introduction. It was rhetorical, and it was the 17 or 18 powers that said most of what Congress could do, the rest being scattered in other parts of the Constitution, such as Article 2's statement that the President could enter into treaties with the advice and consent of the Senate. Well, President Washington, of course, hearing of this argument, had extended debates over several sessions in his cabinet and finally asked for written opinions in which Jefferson laid out the understanding that he and Madison shared. He said, "I understand the underlying principle of the Constitution to be that whatever powers are not granted to the federal government by this Constitution or denied by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." This was the 10th Amendment, which had not yet been ratified, but as we've seen, was already something that was already a principle that the Federalists had told people during the ratification debates was implicit in the Constitution. Hamilton, on the other hand, said, well, everybody agrees that some powers are implicitly granted. And here he was talking about the Necessary and Proper Clause at the end of Article 1, Section 8. But it's essentially stood for the idea that there were some things that was necessary for Congress to do to exercise the powers that were expressly granted. For example, where it said in Article 1, Section 8, Congress could coin money, clearly that would mean Congress had to obtain bullion, hire a mint master, hire an engraver, obtain a building, and so on. So Hamilton said, well, everybody agrees that some powers are implicitly granted. Then the question becomes, what powers are implicitly granted? Well, I understand in looking at Article 1, Section 8, there are various powers related to the economy, the power to regulate trade with the Indians, the power to regulate weights and measures, power to coin money, power to regulate trade with foreign countries, power to regulate interstate commerce, and so on. So Hamilton said, now elsewhere in the Constitution, there are express statements of things Congress can't do. So it can't, for example, adopt an ex post facto law. But he concluded, I think that where the ends are legitimate and the means are not prohibited, the means are constitutional. And he would have found this general power to do whatever the government thought was related to the economy in the Necessary and Proper Clause, that it was necessary and proper to do what Congress found useful in connection with those various economically related powers I just listed. Now, of course, Jefferson, in the oral discussions in the cabinet, had answered this, and he had in his written memorandum to Washington said, clearly it's not necessary to charter a bank in order to coin money. It's not necessary to charter a bank in order to regulate weights and measures. It's not necessary to charter a bank in order to regulate trade with the Indians. There's no one of these powers in connection with which it's necessary to charter a bank. Hamilton said in his memorandum, well, okay, when people use the word necessary, they don't always mean strictly necessary. They might mean useful, helpful, conducive to. And so that's how I understand the Necessary and Proper Clause. Congress, under the Necessary and Proper Clause, can do whatever it thinks is useful in connection with any of those other powers listed in Article 1, Section 8. And those fell into the general rubrics of foreign policy and the economy, so that didn't really leave much of anything. Basically, the way to understand this is that there's going to be a very wide-ranging kind of claim of power by Hamilton. Hamilton also issued Congress what was called a report on manufacturers. Here he proposed a very aggressive corporate welfare in which Congress should subsidize particular industries, give monopolies to particular industries, and so on. Congress rejected that proposal. By this point, a large coterie of people behind James Madison in the House were beginning to call themselves the Republican interest. Now, by calling themselves Republican, of course, they were implying that their opponent, their adversary, Hamilton, was not a Republican. And in 1792, which is the date by which political scientists have identified these couple dozen congressmen who were voting with Madison across the gamut of issues, in 1792, if you weren't a Republican, you were a monarchist. So for these people to call themselves Republican was to imply that their opponents, led by Secretary Hamilton, were monarchists. And they believed Hamilton wanted to make the country more monarchical. One reason they believed that is that he'd said so. He stood up in Philadelphia on June 18, 1787, and went on and on about how he would like a president who served for life, to appoint senators who served for life, and so on and on. And this sounded exactly like the Polish Constitution mixed with the British Constitution. That is, appointed people in the upper house, and an elected monarch, which is what they had in Poland in the 18th century, and, well, in fact, Hamilton said he thought the British model of government was the best one in the world. There was a time when, according to Jefferson, Jefferson had Hamilton, John Adams, the vice president, to his house for dinner, and at one point John Adams said, well, if you could get the corruption out of it, the British would have the best constitution in the world, and Hamilton immediately replied, no, if you could get the corruption out of it, it wouldn't work. It's already the best constitution in the world. So this is the kind of statement that you find in Hamilton. It's not clear whether he's tweaking Jefferson, who certainly seems not to have had much of a sense of humor, and Hamilton seems to have had a sense of humor. So maybe he was being a little bit silly, but it seems, too, that what they called corruption in the British Constitution, which was the monarch's ability to manipulate people in the House of Commons by granting contracts and appointments and ultimately elevating people to the House of Lords and so on, was corruption, and people thought this was legitimate. In 1791, Jefferson responded to this in part by hiring a fellow named Philip Freneau to work at the State Department as a quote-unquote French translator. Well, of course, Jefferson spoke French fluently, and he only had five people working for him, so the idea that he needed a French translator is a little far-fetched. What Jefferson actually intended for Freneau to do was to set up a newspaper whose business would be regularly to attack Hamilton. And that's what Freneau began to do. In the spring of 1792, Jefferson privately confided to President Washington that he believed that Secretary Hamilton was trying to undermine republicanism. Hamilton, for his part, believed that the Republicans, led by Madison in the House and Jefferson in the cabinet, were trying to undermine the Constitution. And he thought they were doing this for selfish purposes, basically for Virginia's own interests. In 1792, the Republicans decided they would make a trial run at running somebody for a national office, and they chose Governor George Clinton, Hamilton's own old adversary from ratification days, as their candidate for vice president. They put him up in Virginia, New York, and Pennsylvania, and he did well in Virginia, New York, and Pennsylvania. It wasn't that they expected him to be elected, but they were trying to see whether it would be possible for a non-federalist to pull in significant support, and Clinton did. So what we should understand about the Republicans was that they weren't a party. Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, these people wouldn't have agreed that they were parts of a political party, but they saw themselves as friends who had common ideas and basically were good Republicans, which meant they were supporters of the Revolution. That this wasn't a party, as it was understood by people in the late 18th century. It wasn't a party in the sense of a faction, as Madison had described that term in Federalist Number 10, but it's what one political scientist called a proto-party. It was a group of people who tended to try to advance common goals in the legislature and certainly outside the legislature. In 1793, Washington, tired of criticism in the press and tired of politics in general, made clear that he'd like to quit. So he went to James Madison, who had helped him at the time of the first inauguration with drafting his inaugural address and drafting his response to the House and Senate responses to his inaugural address, and asked Madison please to draft him a farewell address. This wasn't going to be a speech. George Washington didn't give speeches. This was going to be a kind of op-ed column for newspapers. So Madison drafted a farewell address for 1793, late in 1792. He gave it to Washington. He told him, you can't retire. The reason you can't retire is there's no one to succeed you. Who would take your place? Would it be Hamilton? Would it be Jefferson? Would it be Adams? The Union might very well fall apart, he told him. You need to stay on for another term. And at that point, Hamilton, Jay, Jefferson all also went and told Washington the same thing. So Washington agreed reluctantly that he would stay away from Mount Vernon for yet more years. Remember, he had been away from home for 8 years during the Revolution, and now he'd been away from home for 4 years as president. There are going to be four more to come. As soon as Washington made clear that he was willing to take another term, Jefferson and Hamilton both told him they were leaving. Now, but Jefferson was going to leave soon, and Hamilton, it turned out, didn't leave for a couple of years more. But anyway, this must have been unhappy. It must have seemed almost a betrayal to Washington, who was reelected unanimously in the Electoral College. In 1793, the Jay Court handed down its decision in the very important case of Chisholm versus Georgia. The case wasn't important in itself, but the reason it was important was it involved a citizen of one state suing another state in federal court. And there was an immediate backlash after the Supreme Court decided it did indeed have jurisdiction over such cases, because there was nothing in Article 3 of the Constitution that said either that this was among the types of cases over which the Supreme Court had original jurisdiction, or that this was among the types of cases that Congress could empower the Supreme Court to hear originally, and so, or to hear as an appellate matter. And so the Congress almost immediately sent to the states for their ratification the 11th Amendment, which was adopted in 1798. And I like to think of the 11th Amendment as saying essentially, look, federal courts, we told the world in Article 3 of the Constitution, these are the kinds of cases federal courts can hear, and that's it, no more, we really meant it. So here we see that the people were on guard in the 1790s for federal overreaching. We could wish that 220 years later they were still equally as vigilant. Besides the economic divisions of the 1790s, there was also a foreign policy division. Jefferson, who had been America's minister to France from 1784 to 89, was very pro-French. He, in fact, had been involved in the early stages of the French Revolution, helping Lafayette and other reform-minded nobles and others to draft what became the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. Besides that, Louis XVI was a friend of America's during the Revolution. But on the other hand, Alexander Hamilton said he wanted to stay out of the wars of the French Revolution because America's finances required ongoing trade with the British. 90% of American tariff revenue coming from trade with the British meant that the Treasury Secretary had every reason to want not to disrupt relations with the British by taking the side of France. And Hamilton argued that we didn't really have any commitment to this new government anyway over time. There had been a treaty in 1778 of mutual defense, but by the time this came to a debate in the cabinet in 1793, Hamilton said we should stay out of it because while Louis XVI had been America's ally, the Republicans who had thrown him out of office and ultimately were going to kill him had nothing to do with Louis XVI. Besides that, he made the point that this would wreck the federal government's finances. And on the other hand, Jefferson denied that the fact of the Bourbon monarchies having been replaced in France absolved America of its responsibilities under the treaty with France. He said we still had a legal obligation because it was up to the French to decide what kind of government they were going to have. And if they wanted to replace their monarchy with a republic, good for them. That didn't mean we were no longer to uphold our end of the bargain of the Treaty of 1778. He also said we had a moral obligation because France had been so helpful to America in the Revolution. And we had an ideological obligation because once the war started, effectively they pitted the one other great republic in the world, the greatest one, France, against a league of monarchies who hoped to end republicanism in France and restore the Bourbons. Washington took a kind of middle position that was closer to Hamilton's by issuing in 1793 a neutrality proclamation. What the proclamation said was any American citizen who took either side in the wars of the French Revolution would be punished, would be prosecuted. It avoided using the word neutrality because Jefferson believed that if America declared itself neutral despite its treaty obligation to France, then France would be entitled to take reprisals under the law of nations as understood in 1793. So this word was omitted, but Hamilton instantly went into newspapers and said the equivalent of, boy, didn't you like the president's neutrality proclamation, thereby denying Jefferson his hard-won debate victory and undermining the claim that America wasn't violating its treaty obligations. Besides that, Hamilton tended to try to undermine the Secretary of State's foreign policy. At one point, he actually told the British minister not to worry about the positions that the Secretary of State was taking because, as Hamilton put it, in the end, we think in English. In other words, our sympathies are going to tend to be with Britain, whatever this Francophile Jefferson may say. In 1794, the country was rent by the Whiskey Rebellion, which was a backcountry tax revolt. And you might think that Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, would be distraught that a tax revolt would tend to undermine America's credit, but he saw it as an opportunity. He persuaded Washington to have four states call out a significant number of militiamen, and then George Washington became the only president in history who literally hopped on his horse and led the army. He was going out into western Pennsylvania to take on the Whiskey Rebels, who like roaches when the lights go on, scurried into the corners. And only a couple of guys were caught and prosecuted. They were convicted of treason, and Washington pardoned them. In 1795, Hamilton retired. That was also the year of the Jay Treaty imbroglio, and what happened there was that since there remained outstanding issues with the British, one was impressment, forced conversion of American sailors into British Navy sailors, and one was the ongoing stationing of British troops in what is now the Midwest, Detroit, notably, and on the American side, omission to do what the treaty had required of America by returning property to loyalists and making it possible for British creditors to recoup their expected profits in American courts. John Jay went as American emissary to Britain to negotiate a treaty. People complained immediately. This violated the separation of powers principle. Here was the Chief Justice as a member of the executive branch, but they didn't know that in private John Jay had already said, or maybe he said it later. Anyway, John Jay thought of himself as supporting the Washington administration even as Chief Justice. He went off to Britain and negotiated a treaty that did not get rid of impressment, did not give America open access to British ports in the Caribbean colonies, and people were very unhappy with this. A lot of people were. So in the early stages of the debate about the Jay Treaty, it was unpopular, and Republicans organized public demonstrations, public dinners, public speeches, letter writing, editorials, and so on. It seems to have been a very anti-Jay Treaty environment But eventually, the Federalists answered with the same kind of popular mobilization, and in the end, not only did the Senate ratify the treaty, but the House, over Madison's strenuous organizational efforts, voted narrowly to fund the Jay Treaty. This struck Republicans, some of them, as a defeat, but not a very significant defeat. In fact, one prominent Federalist said he thought that this was a Pyrrhic victory because what the Federalists had had to do was to stoop to Republican organizational methods. They'd had to bring the populace into what should have been a debate among the elite over the question of America's foreign policy and the constitutional role of the House of Representatives in the treaty-making process. So this did not augur well for the future of the Federalists, it seemed. Anyway, in 1796, Washington finally did retire. John Adams was elected narrowly to succeed him, with Thomas Jefferson as vice president. Jefferson's running mate was Aaron Burr of New York, but there was not a tie for second place because the Republican electors did not all vote for Burr. Burr was going to remember that in 1800. Several Virginia electors in 1796 who had pledged to vote for Burr along with Jefferson did not do so in 96. In 1800, this would come back to bite the Republican Party. Anyway, having been replaced, George Washington left office with a farewell address. This time he didn't go to Madison, who by this point was clearly an opponent of his and kind of written out of his memory by Washington. But instead he asked Hamilton for help in drafting a farewell address. He gave him the short version that Madison had written in 1792 and said, "What can you make of this?" Hamilton, as was his habit, made it much, much longer, and so Washington cut it and gave it back to Hamilton, who got together with John Jay and made it briefer before finally Washington put the finishing touches on his famous farewell address, which included three key bits of advice. First, Washington said, "Keep the Union. The Union is essential to American liberty." And what he meant by that was that he feared, as other people feared, as people had feared during the ratification contest, that if the United States broke up into constituent parts, whether all the states became independent or whether regional confederacies, what would happen is that they would be sucked into European politics as perhaps New England and New York allied with Britain and the middle states allied with France, or who knew what would happen. But that would lead to higher taxes, big armies, wars. You couldn't have Republican government in a scenario like that. And so Washington said the first thing is, please keep the Union. Secondly, for those of you who are common citizens, your role in politics is supposed to be, under the federal constitution, vote for a congressman every 2 years. Other than that, stay out. No public dinners, no demonstrations, no mobs with torches chanting outside people's doors. You're to let the elected officials exercise their judgment on your behalf, and the election should be based on choosing the people who have the best judgment. Thirdly, Washington said, do not have foreign countries as friends, because when you have foreign countries as friends, you get their enemies. And this is a way to be sucked into foreign wars with all the implications for the future of republicanism that I mentioned a minute ago. So Washington said that America should stay out of foreign alliances. Of course, this remained America's foreign policy virtually uninterruptedly all the way down to World War II. America didn't really tend to have ongoing alliances because people thought that if you were going to have a republic, you didn't want to have wars, and wars were what alliances brought you. Washington's retirement after two terms was going to be the last of the precedents he set that would be binding on his successors. There's only one case in American history in which a president decided to seek more than two terms, and as soon as that president, Franklin Roosevelt, passed into history, Congress hurriedly sent to the states, and the states ratified an amendment making it formal part of the Constitution that presidents will serve only two terms. It was a very important precedent that Washington set, because what his leaving office showed was that we weren't going to have a monarch. It had been implicit in Washington's behavior before, but that set it in stone. America was not going to have a monarch. It was not going to have a military chieftain. It was going to have elected officials who served briefly and then returned to their vineyards.